Welcome to the Hairdryer Treatment Podcast, powered by Kevin Grogan Soccer, Soccer Coffee, and much more. Welcome to the show this week. Delighted to have an interview with Gary Pritchard later on. Gary is a team building coach and a mental skills coach. He's worked with many organisations, including the New York Red Bulls. For now, though, just talk about some hot topics. I mean, one story that's really interesting to me is the fact that David Beckham has now bought into the Salford City FC brand and club in Manchester. For those who don't know, Salford City was bought by the class of 92 initially, which was Gary Neville, Phil Neville, Paul Scholes, Ryan Giggs, and also Peter Lynn, who's a very wealthy businessman. There was always a question mark why David Beckham wasn't initially involved with that, but he was obviously busy with his own franchise in the MLS in Miami, so he was so busy trying to get that up and running that he couldn't get involved in this. But as of today, it's been launched that he's bought in for 10%, so now it's the full class of 92 involved in that. And for those who don't know, they're called the class of 92 because that's when they graduated from the Manchester United Academy. They were some of the most successful players in the history of the game. A lot of local lads from Salford area, obviously Paul Scholes and Nicky Butt from there, and the Neville's not too far away. Ryan Giggs, Salford. Beckham was from London himself, but obviously came down to the club when he was very young. So very interesting that he's got involved. He's a massive brand, a massive name. Salford are a club that are building themselves up each year. They're moving up the ranks, and I think their goal is to be a championship team in the years to come. They also have set up their academy, Academy 92, where they bring in young players and develop and produce them. So it's a really interesting project, and it's kind of fitting that David Beckham has come in now and has kind of rounded off the group. He obviously has a lot to offer in terms of his knowledge of the game, played in many big clubs around the world, PSG, obviously Real Madrid, Manchester United, captained England, and I'm sure he has a lot to offer them, and it's a great project that they've put together, and I'm sure they'll have lots of success. So after the break, delighted to have Gary Pritchard in as our guest this week. Thank you.
We may be the chihuahua.
You are an ostrich.
Eggs. Dilly din dilly dong, come on.
I want to be clear. I don't want to play mind games.
But I think it was an angry man. I think he was disturbed for some reason or other.
Honestly, I will love it if we beat them.
So, Gary, let's start by talking about how you got into team building initially.
Well, you know, Kevin, it was kind of a road. You know, you take working with players, and you noticed a couple of things that happened. One was is that you had that 11 great players, or you had a team of pretty great players, but you never got that point where they had that synergy where they really went to the next level. So that started me digging into the whole wooden thing in a lot of different areas. One of my influences was a guy by the name of Greg Dale that put out a wonderful book about 101 different team building activities. And all of a sudden I realized that, you know, we talk about the four pillars of every sport, right? The technical, the physical, the mental. I think team building is actually like the hidden fifth element, you know, because it has such an impact on it, you know.
And it falls into the mental aspect a lot as well.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, as they say, you know, that you get 11 great players that are all pulling together, it's going to get that synergistic. It's more than just the number. It expands.
Absolutely. And I mean, Gary, we've worked a lot together, but I've seen you work with players. I've seen you work with board members. I've seen you work with coaches. You've kind of done it all. What do you find in the difference when you work with coaches in comparison to players or the parents?
Yeah, I mean, it's a different thing. You know, you've got coaches out there that, you know, are what I call the inquisitive, the learning coach that never is always looking for just one little thing that's going to make them a little bit better. Those are the coaches that are really exciting to work with because it's very synergistic. He might say, hey, you know, I've tried this, and I'll say, hey, have you ever tried this with your team? Or I love it when I'm with a bunch of coaches and they go, you know, this year I've got such a challenge with my team. It's just not right. And because I'm fascinated about what makes teams work. In fact, my wife laughs because we'll be out at a restaurant or whatever, and she'll go, "You're checking out the team culture in here, aren't you?" And I go, "Absolutely."
Never switched off. Now, I talk a lot, Gary, about kind of, you know, mental health in youth sport and parents and coaches putting too much pressure on kids, and obviously part of what you do within team building and mental skills. Do you see a lot of that where, you know, there's maybe parents even coaching their kids after games or, you know, after sessions, and, you know, there's too much pressure on the kids to so-called make it?
Yeah. In fact, you know, as you know, I have a private practice where I deal with a lot of kids, you know, either Skype or FaceTime. All over the country, and one of the things that I always get into is I ask the kid, I go, "So tell me," I said, "how are mom and dad?" And I specifically asked them about the PGA, and there's like, you know, one of the kids said to me, he goes, my dad doesn't play golf." I said, "No, it's the PGA stands for the post-game analysis. Are you getting grilled every night or afternoon after the game about, you know, wow, you could have done this, you could have done this?" And you go, "Oh, yeah." And I think that's the biggest thing is, somewhere along the line, parents have just gotten so wrapped up in the kids' youth sports that they forget to ask that question, whose sport is it? Theirs?
Yeah, is it a case that they're living, they're kind of trying to relive their youth through their kid? Is it a case that they're so competitive themselves, you know, they want to win at all costs, and that leads them to put pressure on the kid to make sure they win on a weekend? Is that part of it?
Yeah, I think so. And it's interesting you said that, because one of the things that I've noticed in my work is the parents that are the most chill and laid back are the ones that played at a pretty high level themselves, and they get it. And, you know, the ones that maybe didn't have much of a physical or a sports career seem to kind of be reliving or living through their child's experiences. And they do. They put undue pressure. And when I talk to the kids sometimes, I'll say, you know, and I, usually my first meeting I have with the parents just to kind of get a little, you know, buy-in. And the parents will say, "Oh, that's not me." And you'll see the child just roll their eyes. They go, "Come on." And it's sometimes subtle. They'll say things like, "Oh, you know, better eat good today. You got a big game tonight, blah, blah, blah." And they it's subtle, but there's pressure. And I don't know if you've ever seen it, but there's an awesome YouTube that's on. It's about this. It's all set up. It's the dad's like Friday afternoon golf game, and they're all on the golf green, and the 14-year-old son is standing over his father, who's got about an 8-foot putt with all of his buddies watching, and it's just the reverse.
The roles are reversed. I've seen it. Yeah, it's very good.
Yeah, it's very, very good. And the bottom line is the kid is just berating him, like, "Come on, you can't miss this. You know, all the money I put into your sport, and, you know, you know how to do this. Come on, don't, oh, I can't believe you missed it," you know, and watching the father's shoulders drop and the body language. It's a classic case of a wake-up call, though, for some parents about that.
Yeah, and I've heard you talk a lot about the different personality traits and the different letters, and you've done a lot of work with my teams over the years. You talk a bit about that, how everyone in the dress room has a different personality and how you have to be aware of that as a player and a coach?
Yes, I think it's wonderful. It's the DISC principle. It really goes back to Briggs and Meyer. It was a mother-daughter that invented a kind of a behavioral profile to be used originally to help women get a job during World War II when all the men were off fighting in World War II. So they came up with this kind of profile to help match up jobs to people that made, you know, kind of matched up to their behavioral style. And it really didn't change much since the late 40s. They kind of tweaked it in the 60s. But for us, about maybe 7, 8 years ago, I was at the National Soccer Convention we were talking about earlier. And this gal, who was the volleyball coach at UCLA, introduced it to the soccer coaches. Since then, the DISC principle idea has been used in sports a lot. There's a company in Australia called the Athlete Assessment thing that they have a whole thing on the DISC principle. I use it all the time, and because there are four basic parts to it. There's the dominant, the interactive, the steady, and the more compliant, or the questions. And when I've used this, what it does is it allows the coach and the players to really see what the makeup of their team is. And it's really interesting, Kevin, is that, like, this was goes back several years ago. I was working up at a camp that I helped build up in upstate New York called Golden Goal. And Chris Armist was there. He, at the time, he was working with Adelphi University women's. And Chris and I had a great time together, and I took him and his team through this. And when it was all done, we got all the kids up and got them into the XY axis where there were so many D's in this corner, there's so many I's and so on. And I could see very clearly after doing this for many years, Chris had a lot of S's and a few I's, but very few of the dominant D's that really are sometimes, they're all important, but those D's are important for really pushing the team and driving them and helping them be successful. So at that point, I said to Chris, I said, Chris, I don't know how successful you're going to be this year, but you guys are going to have a lot of fun. And anyway, the long story short, I ran into him when he started working over at Red Bull. And I said, hey, Chris, I said, how was that season? He said, Gary, you called it. It was just, we were a little bit above 500, man, but we did have a good time.
Yeah. It's really interesting, obviously, then, with the personalities and in the dressing room and how you cope with that. I mean, one thing you've always talked to me about is people, particularly youth players, when they make a mistake, not dwelling on that mistake. And I know you have some mental cues and the word delete and even writing D on your hand just as a mental cue. Talk to me a bit about that. I find that very fascinating and very helpful for young players.
Yeah, I mean, for the smaller youth players, I mean, one of the things that we do, I call it, some of the things that I use and coaches agree with me, it's a little bit, I would call, edutainment. What I do is I try to get something that's clever, fun. They may laugh about it, but they're going to remember it when it really matters. So if you took all of the different challenges that, you know, and let's face it, mental skills are just like anything with a player. Not one size fits all, but one of the common things that we see, especially in young youth players, is their ability to let go of a mistake. Typically, what happens is they make one mistake, then they make another. It's like that car going down the road and the front fender starts to
walk.
And
just keep dwelling on the mistake.
Yeah, and it can be perpetuate itself. So one of the things that I came up with were just some clever little things. I use a toilet flusher to be able to tell them to be able to flush it. And it's just a visual cue. And the idea behind it is, hey, listen, we want you to be focused on the moment. We want you to get back into the game. We want you to have that bounce back ability. So when we dwell on a mistake, we're no longer in the moment, we're in the past.
Yeah.
And you've seen me use my rearview mirror that I put up just to talk about the players that, you know, you're looking behind you, man.
Relates to any sport, really. It could be golf where you miss a putt and then you're dwelling on that for the next shot when you're teeing off. And it's just having the ability to delete that memory and bounce back. It was bounce back ability you mentioned?
Yeah, bounce back ability. And one of the helpful things for coaches is take a ball out of your bag. There's always one that's never got enough air in it. Take one that's really pumped up and say, here's the difference between average players and you go to bounce the ball and the thing just goes blah.
Yeah.
And it just stays there versus and then a nice full ball pressured up that bounces back. And that ability to be able to, and it's just a visual cue to say, hey, listen, we need you back. We need you in the moment. And, you know, if you're a coach, you know how many times you say, come on, head up, get back in the game.
I mean, I've seen it work with my players that you've worked with and, you know, they write D on their hand and they go into games or tournaments and you do see the impact where you can remind them to look on their hand and they see the D for delete and they delete that mistake and they get on with it. It does work.
Yep, hit the delete button is one. Sometimes we run, so often when they're off the field, they run the negative, I call it the negative movie. They replay all the things they did wrong. And I use the clicker, you know, for your remote, like change the channel, man. Let's get on the positive side. And that's one of the things that we reinforce with the parents as well.
Is that one of the difference between an elite player and the players just below? An elite player at the highest level can move on quicker? That's surely a trait that they have, that they can just get on with it. Their bounce back ability is quicker as such.
Yes, and you know, so much of it, Kevin, and here's a good question for you. I mean, you were at Man U. I mean, when you were playing at that time, what were some of the struggles that you saw either personally or within your teammates that relate?
Yeah, I mean, when I was there, I would have been there mid-90s, and the whole kind of psychology aspect wasn't there, and team building wasn't really there. It was a bit of an old school mentality. But then through the latter part of when I was there, 99-2000, when Steve McLaren came in as the assistant coach, he brought in Bill Beswick, that I'm sure you know. And Bill, for our listeners, is a legend in this kind of industry. And that's when it started to change in Manchester, you know. So I would have been on the tail end of that. And I think there was a famous story that when Steve McLaren went to Sir Alex Ferguson and said, listen, we should bring a psychologist in, a team building coach. And Alex Ferguson brought him into the office and said, asked him one question. And I think the question was, how can you help us stay at number one? And like that, Bill Beswick answered and said, train, play and act like you're number two, which I think was brilliant. And he got the job on the spot. So it was just starting to come in at that period, kind of near the latter stages for me. So I kind of missed out on that. But now, obviously, as a bit more of an experienced person and I'm now a coach, I totally understand the importance of it, you know?
Yeah, you know, I think what's happened is you know, when I played, and it was like, kid, either you have it or you don't.
Yeah, it was old school.
It was old school. And now we realize that mental skills are just like technical skills. They can be learned. And just as many things that coaches are training in terms of, you know, touch and settling the ball and heading and so on, there's composure, you know, concentration, letting go of mistakes, pregame routine, you know, all these different pieces to the puzzle. And, you know, for the players, it's nice because what you're doing is you're empowering them. You're not telling them, listen, this is what you need to do. Here's a strategy that might help you. And they've got to work with it, and they've got to practice it. The good thing about mental skills, though, Kev, is that they practice it at school. They can practice it at home. You see, when we work on the mental side, we're working on the total athlete. We're working on the total person. And I remember meeting Jimmy Castle. He was at the convention several years ago when he was with Man City. And I think he's gone to another team. I think he's either at Nottingham now or whatever. And this summer I was working with one of the youth coaches on the girls' side, Dave. I forget his name. We were out in Houston. And Dave said that Jimmy was a master of really understanding that when we made better people, we got better athletes.
Yeah, that I find that a great mentality, because over the years, particularly when I was younger, looking back on it, I remember so many talented players, like some players that were so skillful and technical, but they never quite made it. And players maybe that had less ability made it. And looking back on it, it was because the players that made it had that mentality, whether it was concentration levels, whether it was discipline, whether it was being able to delete the memory of making mistakes. All them things came into account. And there's a lot of players out there from kind of my era that didn't make it, even though they had a lot of ability. So I think that aspect was neglected. I think now in this era, there's more and more of that. I think Bill Beswick was probably one of the first big ones to kind of hit the scene.
Yeah, he came out with Focus on Soccer. Bill's actually on my Thought of the Day. And every once in a while, we'll send a little something back and forth. Huge respect for the man. He's unbelievable. He's a monster in our business. But, you know, I think also with today's players, they're softer. They need to be coddled a little bit different. And, you know, you talk about the team culture aspect. Look what happened with Man U and Mourinho versus what Gunner's doing right now. What is it? It's nothing to do with the player's ability at all.
I think for me, he probably just took the shackles off and let them play and express themselves a bit more, which is more in line with the so-called Manchester United way. I think the players were very talented. And don't get me wrong, Mourinho's obviously a world-class manager. You just wonder, you know, has he adapted to the times? As you said, the players have changed, whether that's for better or for worse, they have. And you have to deal with that as a manager. And I think Solskjaer's come in and he's let them express themselves. He's let them play with a smile. He himself in the press conferences is brilliant. You know, it's all positive. And I think they were lacking that a bit under Mourinho.
Yeah, you know, this is the thing. So often, you know, you talk about the old school to new school is in the coaching itself. And anybody who's taken a coaching course or is reading or keeping up on stuff, they realize that the directive type coach, although it's wonderful at the lower levels, as we get to these players now, these players have to be empowered. They have to be part of the process. They need to know the reason why. You just can't tell them to get out there and run or get out there and do this. They need to be involved in it. And especially when it comes to that whole team culture thing, the cultures the ones that really do well are the ones that involve the players in the process. They help create the values. They help create the mission. The coach's job is to create the environment or the sandbox that the boys are going to play or the girls are going to play in. But within that, they ask the right questions and they be able to call out great things. So there's not a lot of rules. It's more about, and for me, culture is, hey, this is the way we do it around here. That's the best example of it. So if I came from Podunk, Minnesota, and I showed up, I'd know what I could get away with, what I could wear, how much time I could stay by the water jug before I had to get back out there. And does meaning starting at 2:30 mean 2:30, or can I stroll in 2 minutes later? You know, all these little things, when you talk about what makes successful teams, are in the details. You know?
Yeah, devil's in the details.
Devil's in the details. You know, you know, I don't care what sport it is. You know, you can relate it to watching the Pats play the other night for in the NFL championship game before the Super Bowl. Their discipline and what they've been through and how they do things, that culture is different, and it's not so directive. It's not if I was to relate it to football, it would be like Vince Lombardi. Or yeah. If I was relating it to...
One of the legends, Vince Lombardi.
Yeah, yeah, right. And if I was relating it in the soccer game, like even the Van Gaals and so on, about how they had their players playing, it's much more open now.
It's funny, some Americans who wouldn't know who Sir Alex Ferguson is, the few that don't at this point, but I'd always kind of say, well, he's kind of like the equivalent of Vince Lombardi. Yeah. Only he's won even more.
Yeah.
But that kind of person. I always find with coaching kids, you know, we talk about letting them express themselves, or just players in general, and owning and solving their own problems. You know, when I go in and coach kids, if I'm doing three sessions a week with a team, one session I'll give them a lot of information, another session I'll let them ask the questions and I'll answer, and then the third session I won't say anything. I'll let them organise it, I'll oversee it, and more of a kind of street soccer element where they go and play, they figure it out, and they start thinking for themselves. Because I think they need to do more of that. I think there's too much of this joystick coaching going on that needs to stop.
Absolutely. You know, I have very challenging moments when I'm with a coach and I'm doing the team building, and I set something up, and I'll get the kids doing something with sticks or chains or whatever, and they're all involved, and all of a sudden I see the coach in there, and he's starting to tell him what to do. And I grab him, and he's like, what? I go, mm-mm.
Yeah, yeah.
I said, during the session, all I'm saying to the guys is, fix it. It's not up to your coach to fix it. It's not up to mom and dad to fix it. You got to.
But part of that problem is the coach and is the parent, because they're stepping in, as you said, and they feel like they have to talk and they have to give the answers all the time. So they're part of the problem.
Mm. I tell a story whenever I have a parent. I make it part of if I have a parent talk with a club, like I've been up to your club, and I tell the story about the guy that goes out for a run in the park, and as he's getting his sneakers on, he's getting ready to go. He notices on a bush there's this cocoon, and this you can see it cracking open, and there's a butterfly that's trying to get out or whatever. So the guy, thinking he's doing the right thing, he goes over and he cracks it open and says, here you go, little buddy. And he opens it up and he goes out for his run. And on the way back, he says, oh, I got to see what's going on. And he gets over there. And of course, you know, when he gets there, the butterfly never turned anything. It's this half larva, half out, that's just shriveled up and died, because it's the struggle, man. It's the struggle that makes you strong. It's the struggle that gets you to that next level and gets you going. And if there was one piece of advice that you could give to parents, is back off and let them struggle. Let them make choices. Let them make wrong choices. Because here's the thing, Kevin. You know when parents finally have to back off? When they go to college.
Yeah.
Then the choices are really...
Well, I always say, like, it's our job as coaches with young players to develop and produce them to whatever level that might be. It might be high school. It might be college. Some go on to be professionals. Others, you know, don't do that, but they come back as coaches. Others just love soccer and watch it then when they're adults, or get their kids playing because they have that passion for it. But if you're going to high school, or particularly in college, you're in kind of the real world then, and you don't have your parents there telling you everything and what to do. And coaches are probably in general more qualified, and there's not as much micromanagement, and you've got so many decisions to make, and it's our job to prepare them for that. And part of that is sometimes to let them make mistakes and let them own those problems and solve them. Or sometimes I say, with, you know, U10, U11, U12s, your best players, sometimes put them on the bench, because let them feel what it's like to be dropped, because that's reality. That's going to happen to them at a higher level. But what we're doing is we're wrapping the better players up in cotton wool, coaches in general. And if that 10-year-old is going to score you a hat-trick every week, you're going to play him every week. And then he gets into the real world of college or professional, and he has to deal with adversity, and he's not able to do that. So you're doing them a disservice just because maybe you want to win in the short term as a coach. So I think that's a big issue over here. I think we have to address that.
Absolutely, and I think you hit on a key thing is that, and the other part of it is parents don't realize that the game, you hear these parents that are all jazzed up when they're U9 and U10, it's not even the full-sided game yet. And I call it, it's the man, woman, or the man child that's out there that's huge, that does really well, but he doesn't keep up with it. He thinks, or the parents have praised him, or the coaches wrapped him in that cotton wool. And as a result, that's the guy who never really puts his foot to the grindstone and really works hard. And a lot of the other players surpass him. And some of those kids, as you know, we don't see them anymore by the time they're 14.
Yeah,
they're
I've gone. Seen it so many times. That 8, 9, 10, 11, 12-year-old who's so-called a superstar playing 7-a-side, 9-a-side, and then they get to 14 or 15, and they're burnt out physically and mentally, and they haven't developed as well as they should because they can't deal with the adversity. The parents then get annoyed with the whole situation. They end up dropping out of soccer, which is really, really sad.
It is sad. And the other thing that's sad is that a lot of times the parents are the child's sports agent.
Yeah,
they're moving them from team to team. They're actually going against the coaching staff and so on, and trying to align them into super teams where they're poaching or trying to. It's just absolutely crazy. You know, you look at the European model. They really don't start focusing on the wins until that 15, 16.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in Dublin playing for a club called Belvedere Football Club, which is renowned for producing, I think over 250 players have been produced and signed for professional clubs in the Premiership in England, which is a fantastic, stat. But if you look at the Belvedere clubs, they'll tell you like 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, they very rarely win leagues or cups. But when they start getting to 14 or 15, they start winning everything. Because they've developed the players the right way. They've recruited the right players. They haven't gone just for size. They've gone for quality players who have ability. They've nurtured them. They've absolutely honed in on the fact that we have to play football the right way. We have to be disciplined. We have to work hard. And by the time they get to 14, they start winning, and 15 and 16. And then a lot of the players end up going to England. Some stay, play League of Ireland, and so on. So it's they have patience and foresight to do it. And we need a bit more of that here, I think.
Yeah, and for me, part of my when I stand on my soapbox with coaches is stop with the win, focus on the process. Get away from outcomes. One of the reasons is, and this is probably one of the biggest things that I talk to both coaches and players about, is about the uncontrollables. There's probably nothing that frustrates more players and causes more mental performance drop, or just call peak performance in general, goes down, is they allow the uncontrollables, the rest, the weather, the crowds, the fields, the conditions, the opponents, whatever that might be. Those things that are uncontrollable, and the outcome, bottom line, a lot of times is something that you cannot control. And, you know, we just try to encourage the players to stay with the process. So that means that coaches, before the game, that if they take a couple of minutes with each player and say, what are the two most important things to be focused on? When things don't go well, what should you be thinking about? And one of the things that I always talk about is win. But I don't talk about it as I just explained. I call it W-I-N. What's important now? Right this minute. How can I be, a word we use all the time, how can I be impactful? What can I do that's going to impact the game? How can I do something that's going to kick this thing to another level? Can I be dangerous? And what are those jobs that I can be focused on? That's process. And that really helps with athletes' mental state.
Yeah. I mean, it's really interesting. And like, there's so much good happening in American soccer, obviously. And facilities are great. Coaches are getting better and better. Players are definitely watching soccer more on TV. They're going to more games. That aspect, you know, is changing. The MLS is very strong at the moment. But there still is that underlining problem of some parents, as we talked about, getting too involved. Some coaches doing it for themselves, that win at all costs. Can we change that culture, or is that just something that's always going to be there and we try to manage it?
I think it really starts, believe it or not, it starts with the parents. And the reason for that is because the parents are the ones that hold the purse strings. Let's remember, soccer is business, and it's a big business.
Yeah.
And, there are coaches that feed off of it. You know, remember there was that big splash of all the English coaches coming over and guy speaks, he's got the English accent.
Well, that was funny because I found that funny when I came over. I, I felt there was, and rightly so, probably a lot of the Americans were like, well, you know, just because you have an accent, Irish or English, doesn't mean you're a good coach. And I 100% agree with that. But I think there might have been a period before I came over where some people got away with it. Mm. And maybe they pretended they knew more than they did because they had the accent. Yeah. When I came over, you know, I was kind of glad that was the case because you had to work harder for it. You know, just because we're from a certain area doesn't mean we know what we're doing. And there are a lot of quality American coaches, you know.
When I first started working with Red Bull, I do a lot with Red Bull coaches education. And I think there was between 26 and 35 coaches, and they were all from England, just about,
yeah,
just a few.
Yeah.
And now, of course, that's really grown. I think they're up over 160 coaches, you know, throughout the region. In fact, last time I went in, I had to do it in two different sessions because we couldn't get them all in at the same time because of where they were at. So it's really become a homegrown type of thing. Of course, immigration and all those things have to have a play on that. And please don't misunderstand the fact that those coaches that came from England were fine quality coaches.
Yeah.
I didn't want you to think that.
I went through it myself, and I think some that have come over are absolutely quality. But they're from, by all accounts, there was a period where some people came over and kind of winged it a bit because they had the accent, you know.
Yeah, and I think to kind of hone back in on what you were talking about can we change it? With the parents, you know, it's an education about the fact that, number one, whose game is it? Number two, what does your child want? Ask those two questions. And allow, even to the point of stop going to every game. And what happens is that the child, because we don't have the pickup mentality that you and I grew up with, whether it was basketball or soccer or whatever. And so now it's very structured and very organized. And it's gotten to the point now where we want to destructure that. A good friend of mine, he coaches at Bergen Tech, Nelson Rodriguez. Nelson, I took a couple of my licenses with him. And Nelson has literally gone to that point now where he is just structuring kind of like a free play thing to try to encourage that grassroots again.
That kind of street soccer element. Yeah.
Because what it does is it solves all those problems.
Yeah.
No one's in there fixing it for you.
Yeah.
If you suck, you're going to sit on the sideline until you can get, you know, if you win, you stay on. If you don't. So that answers a lot of questions about why isn't my son playing? I mean, think about the questions that coaches always have to deal with. And it shouldn't be, number one, it should be the child talking to the coach, but about playing time.
Yeah, I do find as well, like in many ways, there's nearly too many cooks in the kitchen because you might be in a club and a technical director has one philosophy and he's pushing that towards the parents. This is what the culture should be. This is how we should conduct ourselves. But then, unfortunately, not all the coaches buy into that. So some coaches then are feeding the parents a different message. And then a lot of boards are too involved in the soccer process rather than running the club. They have a different message. So the parents are probably getting too many messages. And it's what we really need to be doing is probably getting diluted and they're getting confused. Well, is this about winning? Is this about got soccer points? But then he's saying it's not about winning at all. It's about player development and people development. And then someone else over here is saying something else. So I think there's too many cooks and too many messages.
Yeah. And the other thing too is that when you drop your child off at soccer, it should be with a coach, and that's it. And I think the parents are too hands-on, and they're getting in there. There's too many emails and too much nonsense going back and forth. But to your point about culture, one of the biggest detriments to a team culture, if you want to really be successful, and this is no different than business, it doesn't matter what culture it is. You know, I was talking before about the restaurant thing. When you don't have a group that buys into the same philosophy and doesn't have the same, you know, vision. And, you know, we've talked about it at length about if you're a coach, you better know your philosophy, because if you have a good philosophy, there's no gray area. You know the difference. Well, it's the same thing with a club, and especially as it gets larger. When you have a good philosophy and you have values, a lot of the questions and things that could be questionable aren't, first of all, the board doesn't have to get involved in it because you know it's the right thing to do. This is the way it's done.
Yeah.
And so it solves it. But when everybody's kind of doing their own thing, it creates a lot of ambiguities. There's a lot of gray
areas. Anarchy as well.
And then as a result, the wherever that void is, you know there's a parent zipping right in there that's trying to blow the whole thing up and go, yeah. Why is Johnny doing this and Susie's doing that? And it gets to be a mess.
And then in terms of, you know, the individual, and, you know, we talk about kind of mental health and anxiety and depression and putting too much pressure on the kids. Is there, when you get to a certain age, is there a difference on maybe how you deal with a female and a male? I know, I see it a lot, kind of that 13, 14, 15, that kind of when they're going through puberty and different things like that, there's a change and there's a shift, you know, and that's a delicate time. Is there a difference for the males and females, or is that just something you manage as you go?
No, it's definitely different. You know, typically, you know, talking about mental skills, a lot of times parents will come to me and I'll get a phone call and they'll be saying, you know, my son, he's just not doing it. He says in big games, he's just not showing up. He's buckling under pressure. I'm going, okay, so where does he play and how old is he? He says, he's a U9. I just want, I'm like, my gosh, you know. So number one, most kids aren't, unless they're really a pretty sharp kid and really on top of it, I mean, really an exceptional U10, till they're 11, I don't even want, I always tell the parents, I say, leave them alone. They don't even, they're just figuring out who they are.
Yeah.
You know, you appreciate this. I think maybe you and I have even talked about this, the difference between coaching women and men and dealing with that. You know, if a coach goes in at halftime and starts saying, you know, hey, you know, you guys are not working. You're not pushing up. You know, you're not getting your assignments right. No one's charging, you know, going into the box. You know, passes aren't crisp enough. The guys, each one of the guys are going, oh, that's not me. That's definitely, that's him.
There's more ego attached to the guys. I feel the girls at a younger age are way more receptive.
Right. And the exact opposite happens. Yeah. Now, you go over to the other side, and if it's a girls' locker room, every girl in there is going, oh, my God, the coach is talking about me.
Yeah, you know,
They take it so much. So there's this ego difference. And from a team building aspect, guys, it's a hierarchy. Pretty much everybody knows what the pecking order is and where they stand on the team. Girls, it's like a sweater. It's this mesh of all different personalities and caring and so on. And every team though has their cast of characters. You know, the Debbie Downer, or the Builder Upper, the Mother Hen, and so on. So there's all that going on, more so in a girls' team than in a guys' team. But specifically addressing your question. With guys, it takes a little bit more to know what they're thinking. So, like, they'll say something to me and it'll be kind of like a macho remark about, oh, I suck today. And I go, what do you mean? What's that mean? So then I'll say, well, what worked? What didn't? And you start to break it down into bite-sized pieces. And so one of the biggest things that I have with kids that as they get into those teenage years is to make them more self-aware of what's going on. So instead of listening to mom and dad berate them on the way home, I give kids a performance evaluation sheet that I want them to fill out. They're evaluating themselves. So my talk is, hey, don't be just a student of the game, be a student of your game. What's working, what's not. But it's always four positive things that are going well and maybe one or two things that I'd like to work on. With the girls, it's more about building more confidence, because generally they're a little less confident, and so I'm always talking about, hey, if I ask her about their game, they'll always tell me all the things aren't so great.
Yeah.
Well, with the guys, they'll say, you know, I scored 3 goals. I'm the fastest guy on my team. Nobody can outjump me. You know, whatever. You know.
Yeah. Very interesting. And just kind of, you know, talking about some other sports. You know, what in relation to say a sport like golf or tennis, an individual sport. Obviously, the team building doesn't come into it as much, although they would have a team behind them in terms of physios and coaches. But the mental skills aspect of that, is it harder for an individual sports person in a game of golf or tennis than it would be for a team?
Well, you know, I got to qualify that there. There's a difference between it. It's a functional aspect of the sport. So you think about golf. And I don't know if you've ever played, but my brother's an excellent golfer.
The reason I ask is because a lot of my friends are you know, avid golfers, and you know, my dad, and I'm always intrigued with all different sports and how people, you know, use the mental aspect to enhance their game. And golf is, you know, like say snooker or
tennis and particularly golf, it's such a hard sport. So surely the mental skills that are required to play at the top are massive.
It isn't much different. It's just that there's a time frame difference. Think about how much time during a fast-moving pace of a soccer game. It's like a kaleidoscope. Things are moving. You make a mistake, and you've got to be right back there where you're on a 300-yard, 400-yard hole of golf, and you hit that first shot, and it's in the woods, and you're walking, thinking about that shot all the way down there.
That's a long walk.
It's a long walk. So take the so what you've got there is you've got a different functionality about it. In reality, you don't have to concentrate more than between 15 and 20 minutes for an entire 18-round of golf. You're out there for 5 hours. So there's got to be a disconnect and a reconnect for golf. So there's usually a very important pre-shot routine where I've worked with players where they may just fix their shirt, or when they pull their club out, they take the cover off their driver. That locks them in, and then once the shot's away and they've seen the shot through, and by the way, one of the things that's very important, if the shot doesn't go the way they are, good golfers mentally replay the hole and don't leave the negative imprinting. They replay the hole the way they want it to. They'll follow through and swing and see the ball where they wanted it to go, so they don't leave it what I call negative imprinting. They're always making it positive.
Okay, very, very interesting. Yeah.
Here's a good one for your dad, though, if he's a golfer, because one of the things that I talk to soccer players about, I had a perfect example. I had a goalie I worked with at Mahwah High School. A striker. And the coach said to me, she goes, she's my best player. And she is all of a sudden just every ball is right at the goalie. I don't know what's going on. So I said, well, believe it or not, I said, this is going to be an easy fix. So I walked up to her and I said to her, I said, did you ever hear of the law of dominant thought? And of course, the girl's looking at me and said, no. Well, I said, here's the law, but you'll get it in a second. I said, the law says there's no difference between the body and the mind. Don't know the difference between do or do not. They just hear whatever it is. So whether it's your dad on the golf course looking at that water in front of him, don't hit it in the water, don't hit it in the water. What's he focused on, and what is being predominantly sent to the subconscious is water, water, water. In the girl's case, it was don't kick it at the goalie. So as soon as we all of a sudden said, instead of saying that, focus on the corner, focus on the corner. Focus on the ball rolling on the grass beyond. Don't even see the water.
It's like a mental visualization.
Mental visualization. See the ball where you want it to go. And
because they use that a lot, that technique, particularly, you know, outside of practice where you sit down quietly and, you know, you're nearly like a meditation, but you're running through the shot, whether it's striking the ball in soccer or striking the ball in golf. And also it's a great tool for when you're actually injured and you can't actually get out and do it.
That
so you can
correct.
Replay it in your head and you know, that helps a lot.
It does. Specifically, you know, like for instance, Rooney and Drogba, those are two good classic examples of guys that were super visualizations. I read an article in 442, I think it was, where Rooney literally called up the kit manager to know what color jersey they were in tomorrow so that he could visualize it. Because one of the things about visualization that makes it strong is when you involve all your senses.
Yeah.
So when you can smell the turf and you can hear the crowd and you taste the sweat and all the things and the touch of the ball. And it's the same thing with golf. I was at Felician College for a couple of years with a buddy of mine, Simon Nee, who's an academy coach. And I brought in the dartboard one time, and I put it up on the wall, and gave each guy on the team three darts. I said, throw them at the dartboard. Just get it on the board. And, of course, there were a few clowns that put it wherever they wanted to, but most of them tried, but a lot of them didn't even hit the dartboard. So then what I did is I said, okay, just walk up, all the way up, and put your nose about 2 inches away from that bullseye, that orange bullseye right in the center. Focus on it. Focus. Laser focus. Now back out to that 7-foot line. Throw. Their percentage of how close they got to that center and everything was pretty much on the target, except for a few knuckleheads, of course. And the reason behind it is that you want to have that laser focus. So just to say, I hope I get it on frame, or I hope I get it over the water. No, you specifically want to be able to visualize. And, you know, the great golfers like Nicholas was famous for that. Tiger Woods, he would visualize different, you know, angles and different colors in his mind in terms of how the ball might bend with a fade or a loft. You know, so I mean, it's very precise in terms of how they want, where they saw that ball going. You know, because the mind, I'm telling you, the mind is like a garden. What you plant grows. So to your point about physical incapabilities when you're injured, they did a lot of tests with EEG, buttons that they put all over top athletes while they were injured and asked them to visualize what they were doing. And it was amazing because they realized that the muscles, as they were visualizing it, were just miniaturely firing. So just ever so slightly. But it was enough to tick the needle.
Yeah.
And it opened up this whole thing of how valuable, imagery is. So, you know, with my students that are going through, one of the things that I always talk to them about is when you visualize, coach yourself through the anticipated problems that are going to happen. Don't think that it's going to go perfect. That's not soccer.
Mm.
So anticipate, you know, that you're going to be down by one. Anticipate that, you know, you've got a tough opponent against you individually. Anticipate bad calls from the ref. Anticipate bad weather, slippery ball, not enough air in it. Anything you want so that you're more prepared. Oh, I already thought about that. I know how I'm going to deal with this. And have those key words to help you get back into it.
Yeah, it's brilliant. It's fascinating stuff, Gary. You know, you've got such an insight into the game and from the team building and the mental skills. So just to sum up, what message would you give, you know, a youth soccer player? I mean, it's a big question. It's a broad question. But a bit of advice, you know, in terms of, you know, how to deal with all the issues we discussed.
I think the biggest thing is that there's enough stuff online to really start to pay attention to the mental side of the game. And you should ask your coach too, about it. I think it comes from a coach's education standpoint is that, you know, you look across sports now, more and more you see more mental skills coaches and sports psychologists with the big teams.
They're with all the big teams, yeah. There's not a professional team out there that doesn't have someone in this doing this.
Yeah, and now they're starting to require I forget the name of it, there's a governing body for all the academies. I was just talking to Simon about it the other day, and they're actually looking to see if there is someone that's on staff that's going to handle the mental piece, because it is something that, let's face it, by the time they're 16, 17, everybody's fit, everybody's technically sound, you know, and it's the mental piece, that's the difference. And it's something that if we get it started sooner, it becomes part of the...
And as you said, it's a case of the players and the parents taking it seriously and realizing how important it is, doing their own research and taking it very seriously.
Absolutely. And the last point of it is that what we're talking about, those mental skills and those mental techniques, they're something that not only make you significant in your game, but significant in your life. That makes you the difference when you go out for that job interview and so on. You've got the right attitude. You've got the right mindset. You understand that your perception is your reality, and how you see things is how things go, and that you are in control of your effort, your attitude, and how you're going to respond. Huge difference to a lot of people that you see out there.
Brilliant, Gary. Thanks very much.
Hey, great time. Thanks, man.